Get hold of him as he leaves and find out what in the name of God is happening. And then she turns to her ladies and says, I will go straight away and give thanks for the safety of the king. And the court will come with me. She leads the way out of the rooms to the chapel, and the court has no choice but to follow her. The messenger starts to fall into line at the back, but I touch his sleeve, take his arm, back him into a convenient corner, as if he were a skittish horse, and forestall anyone else getting hold of him. What happened? I demand tersely. The queen wants to know. I delivered the message I was told, he says. Not the message, fool. What happened during the day? What did you see? He shakes his head. I saw only a little fighting. It was in and out of the streets and the yards and the alehouses. More like a brawl than a battle. You saw the king? He glances around, as if he fears that people might overhear his words. He was struck in the neck by an arrow, he says. I gasp. By an arrow. The messenger nods, his eyes as round with shock as my own. I know. However was he within range? I demand furiously. Because the Earl of Warwick brought his archers through the streets, up the gardens, and in and out of the alleys. He didn't come up the main street like everyone expected. Nobody was ready for him to advance like that. I don't think anyone has ever laid an attack like that before. I put my hand to my heart, and know with a pulse of pure joy that Richard was stationed in Calais, and not in the King's Guard, when Warwick's men came like murderers in and out of the little alleys. Where was the Royal Guard? I demand. Why did they not shield him? Cut down around him. Most ran off, he says succinctly. Saw the way it was going. After the Duke died.
The Duke?
Cut down, as he came out of a tavern.
Which Duke? I insist.
I can feel my knees are shaking. Which Duke died as he came out of the tavern? Somerset, he says. I grit my teeth and straighten up, fighting a wave of sickness.
The Duke of Somerset is dead?
Aye, and the Duke of Buckingham surrendered.
I shake my head to clear it.
The Duke of Somerset is dead? You are sure? You are certain sure? Saw him go down myself, outside a tavern. He'd been hiding in it. He wouldn't surrender. He broke out with his men. Thought he would fight himself out, but they cut him down on the threshold.
Who? Who cut him down?
The Earl of Warwick, he says shortly.
I nod, recognizing a death feud.
And where is the king now? Held by the Duke of York. They will rest tonight and pick up the wounded. They're looting St. Albans, of course. The town will be all but destroyed. And then tomorrow they'll all come to London.
The king is fit to travel.
I'm so afraid for him. This is his first battle, and it sounds like a massacre. He's going in state, the messenger says mirthlessly. With his good friend the Duke of York on one side, the Earl of Salisbury, Richard Neville, on the other, and the Earl's son, the young Earl of Warwick, hero of the battle, leading the way, holding the king's sword.
A procession?
A triumphant procession. For some of them.
The House of York has the king. They are carrying his sword before them, and they are coming to London.
He's going to show himself wearing the crown so that everyone knows he's well, and in his right mind at the moment. In St. Paul's. And the Duke of York is going to set the crown on his head.
A crown wearing?
It's hard not to shiver.
It is one of the sacred moments of a reign, when a king shows himself to his people in his coronation crown again. It is done to tell the world that the king has returned to them.
that he is in his power. But this is going to be different. This will show the world that he has lost his power. He's going to show the world that the Duke of York holds the crown, but lets him wear it. He's going to allow the Duke to crown him. And we are all to know that their differences have been resolved. I glance towards the door. I know that Margaret will be waiting for me, and I will have to tell her that the Duke of Somerset is dead, and her husband in the hands of her enemy. Nobody can think that this is a lasting peace, I say quietly. Nobody can think that the differences are resolved. It is the start of bloodshed, not the end of it.
They had better think it, for it's going to be treason even to talk about the battle, he says grimly. They say we must forget about it. As I came away, they passed a law that we're all to say nothing. It is to be as if it never was. What do you think of that, eh? They passed a law to say we must be silent.
They expect people to behave as if it didn't happen, I exclaim.
His smile is grim. Why not? It wasn't a very big battle, my lady. It wasn't very glorious. The greatest duke hid in a tavern and came out to his death. It was all over in half an hour, and the king never even drew his sword. They found him hiding in a tanner's shop amid the flayed hides, and they chased his army through the pigsties and gardens. It isn't one that any of us are going to be proud to remember. Nobody will be telling this at the fireside 10 years from now. No one will tell his grandson about it. All of us who were there will be glad to forget it. Not as if we were a happy few, a band of brothers.
I wait in Margaret's rooms as she leads the court back from their thanksgiving for the king's safekeeping. When she sees my grave face, she announces that she is tired and will sit with me alone. When the door closes behind the last of the ladies-in-waiting, I start to take the pins out of her hair. She grips my hand. Don't, Jaquetta. I can't bear to be touched. Just tell me. It's bad, isn't it? I know that in her place, I would rather know the worst thing first. Margaret, it breaks my heart to tell you. His Grace, the Duke of Somerset, is dead. For a moment she does not hear me. His Grace? The Duke of Somerset. Did you say dead?
Dead.
Do you mean Edmund?
Edmund Beaufort, yes.
Slowly, her grey-blue eyes fill with tears, her mouth trembles, and she puts her hands to her temples as if her head is ringing with pain. He can't be.
He is.
You're sure? The man was sure. Battles can be so confusing. It could be a false report.
It might be, but he was very sure.
How could it be?
I shrug. I'm not going to tell her the details now. Hand-to-hand fighting in the streets.
And the king? And the king sent me a message ordering me to lead a service of thanksgiving? Is he completely insane now? He wants a service of thanksgiving when Edmund is dead? Does he care for nothing? Nothing?
There is a silence. Then she gives a shuddering sigh as she realizes the extent of her loss. The king perhaps did not send the message for thanksgiving. I say, it will have been ordered by the Duke of York.
What do I care for that? Jaquetta, how shall I ever manage without him?
I take her hands to prevent her from pulling at her hair.
Margaret, you will have to bear it. You will have to be brave.
She shakes her head, a low moan starting in her throat.
Jaquetta, how shall I manage without him? How shall I live without him? I put my arms around her, and she rocks with me, the low cry of pain going on and on. How shall I live without him? How am I going to survive here without him? I move her to the big bed and press her gently down. When her head is on the pillow, her tears run back from her face and wet the fine embroidered linen. She doesn't scream or sob. She just moans behind her gritted teeth, as if she's trying to muffle the sound, but it is unstoppable, like her grief. I take her hand and sit beside her in silence. "And my son," she says. "Dear God, my little son, who will teach him what a man should be? Who will keep him safe?" "Hush," I say hopelessly, "hush." She closes her eyes, and still she makes the quiet, low noise, like an animal in deathly pain. She opens her eyes and sits up a little. "And the king?" she asks, as an afterthought. "I suppose he is as well as he said. Safe. I suppose he has escaped scot-free, as he always does. Praise God." "He was slightly injured," I say. "But he's safe in the care of the Duke of York. He's bringing him to London with all honour." "How shall I manage without Edmund?" she whispers. "Who is going to protect me now? Who's going to guard my son? Who's going to keep the king safe? And what if he goes to sleep again?" I shake my head. There is nothing I can say to comfort her. She will have to suffer the pain of his loss, and wake in the morning to know that she has to rule this kingdom and face the Duke of York without the support of the man she loved. She will be alone. She will have to be mother and father to her son. She will have to be king and queen to England. And nobody may ever know, nobody can even guess, that her heart is broken. In the next few days, she's not like Margaret of Anjou. She is like her ghost. She loses her voice. She is struck like a mute. I tell her ladies-in-waiting that the shock has given her a pain in the throat, like a cold, and that she must rest. But in her shadowy room, where she sits with her hand to her heart in silence, I see that in holding back the sobs, she is choking on her own grief. She dares make no sound, for if she spoke, she would scream. In London there is a terrible tableau enacted. The king, forgetful of himself, forgetful of his position, of his sacred trust from God, goes to the Cathedral of St. Paul's for a renewed coronation. No archbishop crowns him. In a mockery of the coronation itself, it is Richard of York who puts the crown on the king's head. To the hundreds of people who crowd into the cathedral, and the thousands who hear of the ceremony, one royal cousin gives the crown to another, as if they were equals, as if obedience was a matter of choice. I take this news to the Queen as she sits in darkness, and she stands up unsteadily, as if she's remembering how to walk. "I must go to the King," she says, her voice weak and croaky. "He's giving away everything we have. He must have lost his mind again. And now he's losing the crown and his son's inheritance." "Wait," I say. "We can't undo this act. Let us wait and see what we can do. And while we wait, you can come out of your rooms and eat properly and speak to your people." She nods. She knows she has to lead the royal party. And now she has to lead it alone. "How will I do anything without him?" she whispers to me. I take her hands. Her fingers are icy. "You will, Margaret. You will." I send an urgent note to Richard by a wool merchant that I have trusted before. I tell him that the Yorks are in command again, that he must prepare himself for them to try to take the garrison, that the king is in their keeping, and that I love and miss him. I don't beg him to come home, for in these troubled times I don't know if he would be safe at home. I begin to realize the court, the country, and we ourselves are sliding from a squabble between cousins into a war between cousins. Richard, Duke of York, acts quickly, as I thought he would. He suggests to the palace officials that the Queen should meet her husband at Hertford Castle, a day's ride north of London. When her steward tells her, she rounds on him. "He's going to arrest me." The man steps back from her fury. "No, Your Grace, just to give you and the King somewhere to rest until Parliament opens in London." "Why can't we stay here?" The man shoots a despairing look at me. I raise my eyebrows. I'm not disposed to help him, for I don't know why they want to send us to Henry's childhood home either, and the castle is completely walled, moated, and gated like a prison. If the Duke of York wants to lock away the king, queen, and the young prince, he could hardly choose a better place. "The king is not well, Your Grace," the steward finally admits. "They think he should not be seen by the people of London." "This is the news we have been dreading." She takes it calmly. "Not well?" she asks. "What do you mean by not well? Is he sleeping?"
"He certainly seems very weary. He's not asleep as he was before, but he took a wound to his neck and was very frightened. The Duke believes he should not be exposed to the noise and bustle of London. The Duke believes he should be quiet at the castle. It was his nursery, and he will be comforted there."
She looks at me as if for advice. I know she's wondering what Edmund Beaufort would have told her to do. "You may tell His Grace the Duke that we will journey to Hertford tomorrow," I say to the messenger. And as he turns away, I whisper to the Queen, "What else can we do? If the King is sick, we'd better get him out of London. If the Duke commands us to go to Hertford, we cannot refuse. When we have the King in our keeping, we can decide what to do. We have to get him away from the Duke and his men. If we hold the King in our keeping, at least we know he is safe. We have to have possession of the King." Hertford Castle, summer, 1455. He does not look like the king who rode out to reprimand the great lord with his two friends at his side, dressed for a day of pleasure. He looks as if he's collapsed in on himself, a pillow king with the stuffing gone, a bubble king deflated. His head is down, an ill-tied bandage round his throat shows where the Warwick archers nearly ended the reign altogether. His robe is trailing from his shoulders because he's not tightened his belt, and he stumbles over it like an idiot as he walks into the pokey presence chamber at Hertford Castle. The Queen is waiting for him, surrounded by a few of her household and his, but the great lords of the land and their men have stayed in London, preparing for the Parliament that is going to do the bidding of the Duke of York. She rises up when she sees him, and goes forwards to greet him, stately and dignified. But I can see her hands shaking until she tucks them inside the shelter of her long sleeves. She can see, as I can see, that we've lost him again. At this crucial moment, when we so badly need a king to command us, he has slipped away. He smiles at her. "Ah," he says, and again there is that betraying pause as he searches for her name. "Ah, Margaret." She curtsies and rises up and kisses him. He puckers his lip like a child. "Your Grace," she says, "I thank God that you are safe." His eyes widen. "It was a terrible thing," he says, his voice thin and slight.
It was a terrible thing, Margaret. You've never seen such a terrible thing in your life. I was lucky that the Duke of York was there to take me safely away. The way that men behave. It was a terrible thing, Margaret. I was glad the Duke was there. He was the only one who was kind to me. He's the only one who understands how I feel.
Moving as one, Margaret and I go towards him. She takes his arm and leads him into the private rooms, and I stand blocking the way after them so that no one can follow them. The door closes behind them, and her chief maid looks at me.
"And what happens now?" she asks wryly. "Do we all fall asleep again?"
"We serve the Queen," I say, with more certainty than I feel.
"And you, in particular, mind your tongue."
I have no letter from Richard, but a stonemason who went over to supervise some building work takes the trouble to ride out to Hertford Castle with news for me.
"He's alive," is the first thing he says. "God bless him, alive and well, and drilling the men and maintaining the guard, and doing all that he can to keep Calais for England."
He drops his voice.
"And for Lancaster."
"You've seen him?"
"Before I came away. I couldn't speak to him, I had to take ship. But I knew you'd want news of him. And if you have a letter from him, Your Grace, I'll carry it back for you. I go back next month, unless there are new orders."
"I will write at once. I will write before you leave, I promise. And the garrison?"
"Loyal to Edmund Beaufort," he says. "They had your husband locked up while they broke into the warehouses and sold the wool, but once they'd taken their wages, they let him out again and released the ship from port. That's how I left on the day of his release. Of course, nobody knew then that the Duke was dead. They will know now."
"What do you think they'll do?" He shrugs.
"Your husband will wait for his orders from the King. He's the King's man through and through. Will the King command him to hold Calais against the new captain, the Earl of Warwick?"
I shake my head.
"Drifted off again?"
he asks with cruel accuracy. "I'm afraid so." The King sleeps during the day. He eats lightly and without appetite. He prays at every service. Sometimes he rises in the night and wanders in his nightgown around the castle, and the guards have to call the groom of his bedchamber to take him back to his bed. He's not melancholy, for when there's music, he will tap his hand to the beat and sometimes nod his head. Once he lifts up his chin and sings a song in a wavering, piping voice, a pretty song about nymphs and shepherds. And I see a page boy cram his knuckles in his mouth to stop the laughter. But most of the time, he is once again a lost king, a watery king, a moon king. He's lost his print upon the earth. He's lost any fire. His words are written on the water. And I think of the little crown charm which I lost in the river, and which told me so clearly that there was no season when the king would come back to us. The gleam of his gold would be drowned in the deep water. Groby Hall, Leicestershire, autumn 1455. I take permission from the Queen to leave court and go to my daughter's home at Groby Hall. The Queen laughingly remarks that she could stop a cavalry charge more easily than she could deny me permission to go. My Elizabeth is with child. Her first baby, and it is due in November. I, too, am expecting a baby, a child made from our day and night of love-making when Richard came home and went again. I expect to see Elizabeth safely out of childbed, and then I will go to my own home and confinement. Richard will not be here to see this, his first grandchild, of course. He won't be at my side at Groby Hall, while I wait for Elizabeth's firstborn, nor at our home at Grafton, when I go into my birthing chamber. nor when I returned to Harford Castle, nor in London. His lord, the Duke of Somerset, is dead, and his command that Richard should return to me will not be obeyed. Richard cannot keep his promise to come home to me while the future of Calais is so uncertain. The Earl of Warwick is the new constable of Calais, and Richard will have to decide whether or not to admit the new commander, or defy him. Once again, Richard is far from me, having to decide which side to join, his loyalty on one side, his greater safety on another. And we cannot even write to each other, as Calais has barricaded itself in again. Elizabeth's mother-in-law, Lady Grey, greets me at the door, resplendent in a gown of deep blue velvet, her hair arranged in two great plaits on either side of her head, which makes her round face look like a baker's stall with three great buns. She sweeps me a dignified curtsy. "I am so glad you've come to keep your daughter company during her confinement," she says. "The birth of my grandchild is a most important event for me." "And mine, for me," I say, staking my claim with relish, there being no doubt in my mind that this will be my daughter's son, my grandson, and Melusina's descendant. All that he will have of the Grey family will be the name, and I have paid for that already with Elizabeth's dowry. "I will show you to her room," she says. "I've given her the best bedroom for her confinement. I've spared neither trouble nor expense for the birth of my first grandchild." The house is large and beautiful, I grant them that. Elizabeth's three rooms look east towards Tower Hill, and south to the old chapel. The shutters are all closed, but there is a gleam of autumn sunshine through the slats. The room is warm, with a good fire of thick logs, and furnished well, with a big bed for sleeping, a smaller day bed, a stool for visitors, and a bench along the wall for her companions. As I enter, my daughter rises up from the day bed, and I see in her the little girl whom I loved first of all my children, and the beautiful woman she has become. She is broad as a beam, laughing at my expression as I take in her size. I know," she says, and comes into my arms. I hold her gently, her big belly between us. "Tell me it's not twins." "I tell her it's a girl if she carries so low and broad," Lady Grey says, coming in behind me. I don't correct her. We will have time enough to see what this baby is and what it will do. I hold Elizabeth's broad body in my arms, and then I cup her beautiful face in my hands. "You are more lovely than ever." It's true. Her face is rounded, and her golden hair has darkened a little after a summer spent indoors, but the exquisite beauty of her features, the fine drawn nose and eyebrows, the perfect curve of her mouth, are as lovely as when she was a girl. She makes a little pout. "Only you would think so, Lady Mother. I cannot get through doorways, and John left my bed 3 months ago because the baby kicks me so much when I lie down that I move about all night, and he cannot sleep." "That will soon be over," I say. "And it's good that he has strong legs." I draw her back to the day bed and lift up her feet. "Rest," I say. "You will have enough to do within a few days." "Do you think days?" Lady Grey asks. I look at Elizabeth. "I can't tell yet," I say. "And a first child often takes his time." Lady Grey leaves us, promising to send up a good dinner as soon as it grows dark. Elizabeth waits for the door to close behind us and says, "You said his. You said his time." "Did I?" I smile at her. "What do you think?" "I did the wedding ring spell," she says eagerly. "Shall I tell you what it said?" "Let me try," I say, as excited as a girl. Let me try with my ring. I slip my wedding ring from my finger and take a thin gold chain from my neck. I put the ring on the chain, wondering a little that I should be so blessed as to be dowsing for my daughter to see what her baby will be. I hold the chain over her belly and wait for it to hang still. Clockwise for a boy, Widdershins for a girl, I say. Without my moving it, the ring begins to stir, slowly at first as if in a breeze, and then more positively, round and round in a circle, clockwise. A boy, I say, catching it up and restoring the ring to my finger and the chain to my neck. What did you think? I thought a boy, she confirms. And what are you going to have? A boy, too, I think, I say proudly. What a family we're making. I swear they should all be dukes. What will you name him? I'm going to call him Thomas. Thomas the Survivor, I say. She's instantly curious. Why do you call him that? What is he going to survive? I look at her beautiful face, and for a moment it is as if I'm seeing her in a stained glass window, in a shadowy hall, and she's years away from me. I don't know, I say. I just think he will have a long journey and survive many dangers. So when do you think he'll come? She asks impatiently. I smile. On a Thursday, of course, I reply, and quote the old saying, Thursday's child has far to go. She's diverted at once. What was I? Monday. Monday's child is fair of face. She laughs. Oh, Lady Mother, I look like a pumpkin. You do, I say, but only till Thursday. It turns out that I'm right on both counts, though I don't crow over Lady Grey, who would make a bad enemy. The baby is a boy. He is born on a Thursday, and my Elizabeth insists he shall be called Thomas. I wait until she's up and about. I take her to be churched myself, and when she's well and the baby feeding, and her husband stopped coming to me 10 times each day to ask if I'm sure that everything is well, then I go to Grafton to see my other children, and promise them that their father is bravely serving his king, as he always does, that he will come home to us as soon as he can, as he always does, that their father has sworn to be faithful to us over and over, that he will always come home to me. I go into my confinement in December, and the night before the baby is born, I dream of a knight as brave and as bold as my husband, Sir Richard, and a country dry and hot and brown, a flickering standard against a blazing sun, and a man who is afraid of nothing. When he is born, he is just a tiny crying baby, and I hold him in my arms and wonder what he will be. I call him Edward, thinking of the little prince, and I feel certain that he will be lucky. Hertford Castle, Spring 1456. Richard does not come home, though I write to him from the hushed and fearful court to tell him he's a father again, and now a grandfather too. I remind him that Antony must be sent to serve some great lord, but how am I to judge which one, in this new world that is ruled by York once again? I don't even know if he gets the letter. Certainly I don't get a reply. The garrison and town of Calais are at war with themselves, and are no more welcoming to the newly nominated commander, the victorious young Earl of Warwick, than they were to the former constable, his ally, the Duke of York. I imagine, and I fear it, that Richard is keeping the York allies out of the castle and holding the town for Lancaster. a forlorn hope, and a lonely posting. I imagine that he's keeping faith with Lancaster, and thinks that to hold Calais for the Silent King is the best service he can offer. But through the Christmas feast and the winter months, I cannot get any news of him, except to know that he's alive, and that the garrison has sent word that they will never admit the Earl of Warwick to the castle that is loyal to the man he killed, the dead Lord Somerset. It is not until spring that things start to improve. "The king is better," Margaret announces to me. I look at her doubtfully. "He speaks better than he did," I agree, "but he's not himself yet." She grits her teeth. "Jaquetta, perhaps he will never be as he was. His wound has healed. He can speak clearly. He can walk without stumbling. He can pass as a king. From a distance he can look commanding. That has to be enough for me."
"For you to do what?"
"For me to take him back to London. Show him to the council, and take the power from the Duke of York once more." "He is the shell of a king," I warn her. "A puppet king." "Then it will be me who pulls the strings," she promises, "and not the Duke of York. While we are here, and allow the Protectorate to reign, the Duke of York takes all the posts, all the fees, all the taxes, and all the favours. He will strip the country bare, and we will end up with nothing. I have to put the king back on his throne, and York back in his place. I have to save my son's inheritance, for when he can come of age, and fight his own battles." I hesitate, thinking of the king's nervous tremor of the head, of the way he flinches at sudden noise. He will be unhappy in London. He will be frightened in Westminster. The lords will appeal to his judgment and demand that he rule. He cannot do it. There will be continual quarrels in the council and shouting. He will break down, Margaret. "I will order your husband home," she tempts me. "I will tell the king to pardon the garrison and allow the guard home. Richard can come home and see his grandson and meet his son. He hasn't even seen your new baby."
"A bribe," I remark.
"A brilliant bribe," she replies. "Because it's irresistible, isn't it? So do you agree? Shall we set the king to claim his throne again?"
"Would you stop on this course if I disagree with you?" She shakes her head.
"I am determined. Whether you are with me or not, Jaquetta, I will take command through my husband. I will save England for my son. Then bring Richard home, and we will support you. I want him in my life again, in my sight, and in my bed."
Westminster Palace, London, spring 1456. Richard's recall from Calais is one of the first acts of the restored king. We go in state to Westminster and announce the king's recovery to the council. It goes better than I dared to hope. The king is gracious, and the council openly relieved at his return. The king is now to govern with the advice of the Duke of York. The king pardons the garrison of Calais for refusing to admit both York and Warwick, and he signs a pardon especially for Richard, to forgive him for his part in the rebellion against the Lord Protector.
"Your husband is a loyal servant to me and my house," he remarks to me, when he comes to the Queen's rooms before dinner. "I will not forget it, Lady Rivers."
"And may he come home?" I ask. "He's been away such a long time, Your Grace."
"Soon," he promises me. "I have written to him, and Lord Wells, that I myself appoint the Earl of Warwick as Captain of Calais, and so they can take it as my command that they are to admit him. When they admit the Earl, and he takes his post, your husband can come home." He sighs.
If only they would live together in loving kindness, he says. If only they would be as birds in the trees, as little birds in the nest. I curtsy. The king is drifting into one of his dreams. He has a vision of a kinder world, a better world, which nobody could deny. But it is of no help for those of us who have to live in this one. The king's pain at his unexpected wound, his shock at the brutality of battle and the cruelty of death in the streets of St. Albans, seems to have gone very deep. He says that he's well now. We have given thanks in a special mass, and everyone has seen him walk without stumbling, talk to petitioners, and sit on his throne. But neither the Queen nor I can feel confident that he won't drift away again. He especially dislikes noise or disagreement, and the court, the parliament, and the King's council is riven with faction. There are daily quarrels between the followers of the York lords and our people. Any trouble, any discord, any unhappiness, and his gaze drifts away. He looks out of the window, and he falls silent, slipping away in a daydream. The Queen has learnt never to disagree with him, and the little prince is whisked from the room whenever he raises his voice or runs about. The whole court tiptoes about its business so as not to disturb the king, and so far we have managed to keep him in at least the appearance of kingship. The Queen has learnt to control her temper, and it has been very sweet to see her discipline herself, so that she never startles or alarms her husband. Margaret has a quick temper and a powerful desire to rule, and to see her bite her tongue and hear her lower her voice, so as not to confront the king with the usurpation of his powers, is to see a young woman growing into wisdom. She's kind to him in a way that I thought she could never be. She sees him as a wounded animal, and when his eyes grow vague, or he looks about him trying to remember a word or a name, she puts her hand gently on his and prompts him, as sweetly as a daughter with a father in his dotage. It is a sorry end for the marriage that started in such hopes, and the king's hidden weakness is her hidden grief. She is a woman sobered by loss. She has lost the man she loved, and she has lost her husband. But she does not complain of her life to anyone but me. To me, her temper is not muted, and often she blazes out when we're alone. "He does whatever the Duke of York tells him," she spits. "He is his puppet, his dog." "He is obliged to govern with the agreement of the Duke and with the Earls of Salisbury and Warwick," I say. "He has to answer the objection that the Privy Council made against him, that he was only for Lancaster. Now there is a parliament that is influenced by all the great men, York as well as Lancaster. In England this is how they like it, Your Grace. They like to share power. They like many advisers." "And what about what I like?" she demands. "And what about the Duke of Somerset, who lies dead, thanks to them? The dearest, truest..." She breaks off and turns away so that I cannot see the grief in her face. "And what about the interest of the prince, my son? Who will serve me and the prince? Who will satisfy our likes? Never mind those of the council." I say nothing. There's no arguing with her when she rages against the Duke of York. "I won't stand for it," she says. "I'm taking the prince and going to Tutbury Castle for the summer, and then on to Kenilworth. I won't stay in London. I won't be imprisoned in Windsor again."
"Nobody's going to imprison you."
"You can go and see your children," she rules. "And then you can meet me. I won't stay in London to be ordered about by the Duke and insulted by the citizens. I know what they say about me. They think I'm a virago, married to a fool. I won't be so abused. I shall go and I shall take the court with me, far from London and far from the Duke, and he can give what orders he likes, but I won't have to see them. And the people of London can see how they like their city when there's no court here. and no council, and no parliament. I will see them go bankrupt. They will be sorry when I take the court away, and give our presence and our wealth to the people of the Midlands.
What about the king? I ask carefully. You can't just leave him in London on his own. It is to throw him into the keeping of the Duke of York.
He will join me when I order it, she says. No one will dare to tell me that my husband shall not be with me when I command it. The Duke will not dare to keep us apart. And I'm damned if he will have me locked up in Windsor again.
Grafton, Northamptonshire, summer 1456. I wait for Richard to come home to us at Grafton, enjoying my summer with our children. Elizabeth is at Groby with her new baby, and her sister Anne is visiting her. I have placed Anthony with Lord Scales, serving as his squire, learning the ways of a noble house, and Lord Scales, as it happens, has a daughter, an only daughter, his heiress, Elizabeth. My Mary is 13 now, and I must look around for a husband for her. She and her sister Jaquetta are staying with the Duchess of Buckingham, learning the ways of that house. My boy John is at home. He and Richard are set to their studies with a new tutor. Martha will join them in the schoolroom this year. Eleanor and Lionel are still in the nursery, with their two-year-old sister Margaret and their little brother Edward. I don't have to wait long for my husband's return. First I get a message that Richard has been released from his duty at Calais, and then, hard on the heels of the messenger, I see the dust on the road from Grafton coming up the drive to the house, and I pick up Edward out of the cradle and hold him to me, shading my eyes with my hand and looking down the road. I plan that Richard shall ride up and see me here, my newest baby in my arms, our house behind me, our land safe around us, and he will know that I have kept faith with him, raised his children, guarded his lands, as he has kept faith with me. I can see, I think I can see, the colours of his standard, and then I am certain it is his flag. And then I know for sure that the man on the big horse at the head of the company is him, and I forget all about how I want him to see me, thrust Edward into the arms of his wet nurse, pick up my skirts, and start to run down the terrace of the house, down the steps to the road. And I hear Richard shout, "Hello, my Duchess! My little Duchess!" And I see him pull his horse to a standstill, and fling himself down, and in a moment I'm in his arms, and he's kissing me so hard that I have to push him away. And then I pull him close again to hold him to me, my face to his warm neck, his kisses on my hair, as if we were sweethearts who have been parted for a lifetime. "Beloved," he says to me, breathless himself, "it has been forever. I was afraid you would forget all about me." "I have missed you so," I whisper. My tears are wet on my cheeks, and he kisses them, murmuring, "I missed you too. Dear God, there were times when I thought I would never get home." "And you are released. You don't have to go back again." "I am released. Warwick will put in his own men. I hope to God I never see the town again. It was a misery, Jaquetta. It was like being in a cage for all that long time. The countryside outside is unsafe. The Duke of Burgundy raids, and the King of France threatens. We were constantly alert for an invasion from England and the York lords, and the town was on the brink of bankruptcy. The men were mutinous, and nobody could blame them. And worst of all, I was never sure what I should do for the best. I couldn't tell what was happening in England. And then I could get no news of you. I didn't even know if you were safely up from childbirth." "I kept writing," I say. "I kept writing, but I guess you didn't get the letters. And sometimes I couldn't find anyone to take a message. But I sent you fruits and a barrel of salted pork." He shakes his head. "I never got a thing. And I was desperate for a kind word from you. But you had to manage all alone.
and with a new baby.
This is Edward, I say proudly, and beckon to the wet nurse to come up and hand our son to his father. Edward opens his dark blue eyes and regards his father gravely.
He is thriving?
Oh, yes, and all the others, too. Richard looks around at his other children, tumbling out of the front door, the boys pulling off their caps, the girls running towards him, and he goes down on his knees to them, spreading his arms wide, so they can all run at him and hug him.
Thank God I'm home, he says with tears in his eyes. Thank God for bringing me safe to this my home, and my wife, and my children.
That night in bed, I find I am shy, fearing that he will see a difference in me. Another year gone by, and another birth to broaden my hips and thicken my waist. But he's gentle and tender with me, loving as if he was still my squire, and I was the young duchess.
Like playing a lute, he says with a roll of laughter under the whisper. You always remember the way, when it's in your hand again. The mind can play tricks, but the body remembers.
And is there many a good tune played on an old fiddle? I demand with pretend offence.
If you find a perfect match, then you keep it, he says gently. And I knew when I first saw you that you were the woman I would want for all my life.
He gathers me into his warm shoulder and falls asleep, holding me tightly. I fall asleep in his arms like a mermaid diving into dark water. But in the night, something wakes me. At first I think it may be one of the children, so I struggle awake and slide from under the covers to sit on the side of the bed to listen. But there's no sound in our quiet house, just the creak of a floorboard and the sigh of wind through an open window. The house is at peace. The master is safely home at last. I go into the chamber outside our bedroom and open the window and swing wide the wooden shutter. The summer sky is dark, dark blue, as dark as a silk ribbon, and the moon is on the wax, like a round silver seal, low on the horizon, sinking down. But in the sky, towards the east, is a great light, low over the earth, a blaze of light, shaped like a sabre, pointing to the heart of England, pointing to the Midlands, where I know Margaret is arming her castle and preparing her attack on the Yorks. I gaze up at the comet, yellow in colour, not white and pale like the moon, but golden, a gilt sabre, pointed at the heart of my country. There is no doubt in my mind that it foretells war and fighting, and that Richard will be in the forefront as ever, and that now I have new men to worry about as well, Elizabeth's husband, John, and Anthony, my own son, and all the other sons who will be raised in a country at war. For a moment I even think of the young son of the Duke of York whom I saw with his mother that day at Westminster, young Edward, a handsome boy. No doubt his father will take him to war, and his life will be at risk too. The sabre hangs in the sky, above us all, like a sword waiting to fall. I look at it for a long time, and think that this star should be called the Widow Maker. And then I close the shutter and go back to my bed to sleep. Kenilworth Castle, Warwickshire, summer 1457. Richard and I join the court at the very heart of Margaret's lands, in the castle she loves best in England, Kenilworth. As my guard and I ride up, I see, to my horror, that she has prepared it for a siege, just as the night sky foretold. The guns are mounted, and looking over the newly repaired walls. The drawbridge is down for now, bridging the moat,
but the chains are oiled and taut, ready to raise it in a moment. The portcullis is glinting at the top of the arch, ready to fall at the moment the command is given, and the number and the smartness of the household show that she has manned a castle here, not staffed a home.
"She's ready for a war," my husband says grimly. "Does she think Richard of York would dare to attack the king?"
We come into her presence as soon as we've washed off the dust from the road and find her sitting with the king. I can see at once that he's worse again. His hands are trembling slightly, and he's shaking his head, as if denying his thoughts, as if wanting to look away. He shivers a little, like a frightened leveret that only wants to lie down in the springing corn and be ignored. I cannot look at him without wanting to hold him still. Margaret looks up as I come in, and beams her happiness to see me. She declares, "See, my lord, we have many friends. Here is Jacquetta, Lady Rivers, the Dowager Duchess of Bedford. You remember what a good friend she is to us? You remember her first husband, who was your Uncle John, Duke of Bedford? And here is her second husband, the good Lord Rivers, who held Calais for us, when the bad Duke of York wanted to take it away." He looks at me, but there's no recognition in his face, just the blank gaze of a lost boy. He seems younger than ever. All his knowledge of the world has been forgotten, and his innocence shines out of him. I hear Richard behind me make a small, muffled exclamation. He is shocked at the sight of his king. I had warned him several times, but he had not realized that the king had become a prince, a boy, a babe. "Your Grace," I say, curtsying to him. "Jacquetta will tell you that the Duke of York is our enemy, and we must prepare to fight him," the Queen says. "Jacquetta will tell you that I have everything prepared. We are certain to win. Jacquetta will tell you that when I say the word, our troubles are over, and he is destroyed. He has to be destroyed. He is our enemy."
"Oh, is he French?" the king asks in his little voice. "Dear God," Richard mutters quietly. I see her bite her lip to curb her irritation.
"No," she says. "He is a traitor." This satisfies the king for only a moment.
"What is his name?"
"The Duke of York, Richard. Richard, Duke of York."
"Because I'm sure someone told me that it was the Duke of Somerset who was a traitor. And he's in the Tower."
This sudden reference to Edmund Beaufort, and from the king himself, is shockingly painful to her, and I see her suddenly go pale and look away. She takes a moment, and when she turns back to us, she has herself utterly under control. I can see that she has grown in determination and courage this summer. She is forging herself into a powerful woman. She has always been strong-willed, but now she has a sick husband and a rebellious country, and she's turning herself into a woman who can protect her husband and dominate her country.
"No, not at all. Edmund Beaufort, the Duke of Somerset, was never a traitor. And anyway, now he is dead," she says very quietly and steadily. "He was killed at the Battle of St. Albans by the Duke of York's ally, the wicked Earl of Warwick. He died a hero, fighting for us. We will never forgive them for his death. Do you remember we said that? We said that we would never forgive him."
"Oh, no. Margaret," he shakes his head.
"We must forgive our enemies. We forgive our enemies as we hope to be forgiven. Is he French?"
She glances at me, and I know my horror is plain on my face. She pats his head gently, and rises up from her throne, and falls into my arms, as easily as if she were my little sister, weeping for some hurt. We turned together to the window,